Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, red hard drives save RAIDs. The first things to do with your new PC build, affordable GPUs, what's up with the Ouya console on Kickstarter, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 177, recorded July 12, 2012. These drives will save your RAID. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, America's most exciting show about computer hardware technology. And, well, we even talk about the tablets and occasionally the phones. Why? Because your favorite applications are showing up in your hand these days, whether it's Android, Windows, or, of course, our own beloved iPhone, iOS. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton, and apparently very excited to be here today. And even more excited to be here today, ladies and gentlemen, is our very own Ryan Trout, who has recently, finally, after weeks of nagging, tried the Migas before he left Texas.
It was literally my very last meal. It was literally the last thing I ate before I left the city. It was good. So I want to make sure, like, I don't know if there's different variants, right? So it was like tortilla chips with like eggs and salsa and sauce on it and kind of that mixture. It was good. And I was telling you during the pre-show, I had a mixture of guacamole and queso, like as a chip dip. It was also very good at the same place, Kirby Lane Cafe, I think is where we went. That's what it's called. But it was good. Yes. So while it took me all of the 10 weeks I was there, to take you up on your suggestion, I did do it. It is complete.
I'm glad you did. And now you'll know next time you're in Texas, there's barbecue in the evenings and Migas in the morning, ladies and gentlemen. We should probably talk about computer hardware. That is what the show is about. Twitch, T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv is the email address because we answer questions in the show and we'll answer your question if you send it in to us. Right now, let's take a moment to talk about the Western Digital Red, which is something we've never seen from. We've seen blue labels from Western Digital. We've seen black labels from Western Digital. I own a whole lot of green labels from Western Digital, but this is the Western Digital Red 3TB SATA Soho NAS drive. Alan Malventano, of course, doing the review for PCPer.com. And he says, introduction, I'm going to let the cat out of the bag right here and now. Everyone's home RAID is likely an accident waiting to happen. If you're using regular consumer drives, just like Google, I added the Google part, not Alan, in a large array, there is some very simple and likely scenarios that can cause it to completely fail. And Alan adds that he's guilty of operating under the same false hope. To put it into context, Alan, who does the hardware reviews for PC Per, has, quote, an 8-drive array of 3TB Western Digital Caviar Greens in a RAID 5. And it's kind of interesting. What is the easy way to summarize the red drives for the home viewing audience?
So these red drives are built specifically for RAID and small home office kind of environments, right? They're built for RAID devices. Now, what's interesting about this is most people, and me included, just kind of assumed, well, if you have a hard drive, it can be run in a RAID. Not a big deal. And last night I was educated by Alan and some of the intricacies of what goes on these hard drives. Like I kill a lot of RAID arrays. I'm pretty notorious around here for this. I've had tons of problems with simple things like RAID 1, right? Just doing RAID 1 mirror, make sure I have all my data and a drive would drop, but I could add it back in. It would rebuild and all that. We'd have issues with that all the time. As it turns out, what apparently was causing that is that the drives are timed differently, and like a hardware RAID controller expects a response from a drive in a certain amount of time. And while a consumer hard drive will kind of wait a little bit longer for a response to avoid any kinds of issues, the RAID array, if it doesn't get the response it wants relatively quickly, will just basically determine that drive is bad, drop it, and then you screw up your RAID array, and now you have to go back and fix it, even though the hard drive itself may not necessarily be bad. And that one of the main features that they've added to this RED series that has existed in other hard drives, I forget what the moniker is for the RAID edition of the hard drives. Well, they had a RAID edition drive, but it was more expensive. And the red series is kind of very, very close to the cost of the green series. But as the feature you just mentioned, time-limited error recovery, it limits the hang experience on a read error in order to avoid a RAID controller considering the drive dead or offline. So this apparently would have fixed all the problems I had with RAID arrays over the years. It would have saved me it's innumerable hours and headaches and annoyances if had I known about this. And then they've also added 3D Active Balance Plus. It's enhanced dual plane balance control technology, significantly improves the overall drive performance and reliability. Hard drives that are not properly balanced may cause excessive vibration and noise in a multi-drive system, reducing the hard drive lifespan and degrade the performance over time. So even if the system, the case, your house is not perfectly level, apparently the hardware innards of this hard drive will be able to kind of fix that. And the best part about this is these drives aren't that much more expensive than your Caviar Greens, which, you know, Alan was saying he used Caviar Greens in his array. I think you're probably using Caviar Greens in some RAID arrays.
Yes,
we're using Caviar Greens in the Drobos and all kinds of other things around
Everybody uses the Caviar Greens because they're cheap and quiet, and they actually generate less heat than some of the other drives.
And so these red drives will actually do all of that, plus have these capabilities that they're kind of built for this RAID environment. So the performance on them is actually a little bit better just because of some tweaks they were able to do in the firmware. I think there's one place where the performance is a little bit lower, and that's, I think, in random access time. It's a little bit slower in random access time, which, you know, obviously not great, but when we're talking about for RAID arrays, it's not the biggest deal in the world. If we look at the last page here and we look at the cost, so this was interesting. The 2 terabyte drive, this is kind of like the one most people will kind of lean towards, is $129 currently selling on Newegg. So you can get these Western Digital RAID drives for $129 already today. And I think the green version was $10 less on Newegg. So that gives you, you know, for me, had these drives been around when I was buying all these 2 terabyte drives, I definitely would have bought these. So it's a little bit unfortunate for me in this case, but for everybody else going forward, if you're going to build a 2-drive array, a 3-drive array, you know, you have an external NAS device. Yeah. Anything like that. I would absolutely recommend using these. It's interesting, you know? So if you look at the 3 terabyte version, you're down to 6 cents a gigabyte as well. That's also something else worth noting is the hard drive prices are continuing to come down. We actually did find when we were talking last night, the 2 terabyte green drive for $99 again. So that's
nice.
A good sign overall. But
I would say hard drives are back online. So seriously though, red drives for RAIDs, for large hardware storage situations, stupid quiet, don't use much power. It's interesting. Sequential read and write speeds, excellent. 3-year warranty, 24/7 support, hotline, and a 1 million hour mean time between failure, which is about 35% over most consumer grade hard drives. So great. You know,
yep.
Yeah, it's like, but I just bought 4 3-terabyte drives a few months ago.
We got a lot of that response in the chat room last night while we were talking about this as well. It's one of those things that literally, I think Ken got it one night or one, got shipped to him one day and like the NDA was the next day. So nobody had any kind of forewarning on this here.
NVIDIA is preparing new mid-range Kepler graphics cards. Quote, we have seen and reviewed NVIDIA's high-end Kepler graphics cards, but the company's mid-range line has been even harder to find than the GTX 680 was a couple months ago. Braces are so much fun. Tim Berry writing this for PCPer.com. Refresh of the current GT 640 or something else coming along, Ryan?
So these rumors purport to have information about the 650 and the 660 series. And these are the cards that I think will be incredibly popular if they come out with the specifications that this website, Video Cards with a Z, if they're accurate, right? So the 670 is $399. That's pretty high up there. It's a great card, but it's still pretty expensive for the majority of gamers out there. And then in terms of like Kepler cards, you go all the way down to the 640 we talked about a few weeks ago, which I'm not really a fan of at all. It's not a good card in terms of its performance and relation to what AMD offers and that kind of stuff. So the rumors start from apparently a refresh of the GT 640 that uses GDDR5 memory. Something we knew was going to happen, we just didn't know when. And that will apparently boost up performance of the GK107 GPU to be more competitive with the AMD offerings. Maybe they'll adjust some pricing because of that as well. We go up a little bit further. We get into the 650 Ti. This is actually a new chip, apparently, the GK106. And there'll be two versions of this, actually, of this chip. The 650 Ti and the 660 base. So, like, just the 660. And one of the lower one will have 960 cores. The upper one will have 1,152 cores. They both have 192-bit memory bus. And the price ranges are kind of important here. The 650 Ti will apparently be in the 120 to 160 range. And the GTX 660 will be in that 200 to 250 range, which is, you know, if you kind of look back through the product SKUs that exist today for Fermi cards and that kind of stuff, it makes a lot of sense. And then the what I think will be the most popular one will be the GTX 660 Ti. This is based on GK104, so it's actually based on the same GPU as the 680 and the 670, but will have 1,344 CUDA cores, which again is the same as the 670, but we'll have a 192-bit memory bus instead of a 256-bit memory bus. So you get a little bit less frame buffer, a little bit less memory bandwidth option, but you get the same number of cores, although we don't know what the clock speeds of them might be. And this will be in that $300 price range. So that would, you know, kind of round out the lineup of parts from NVIDIA. And I think it's something they really need to do. I don't know if they're having, you know, we always get into the issues of, is there a supply constraint at TSMC and that kind of stuff? Or they just, you know, they're using a lot of these SKUs on their mobile parts as well. And those are kind of maybe have a little bit more weight behind them in terms of making sure they meet these OEMs demands and that kind of thing. But right now, once you get below the $400 price range, AMD has the best options by far, right? If you look at the 7000 series, they've got great options pretty much up and down the price range. And AMD's Kepler really needs to get below that NVIDIA's Kepler really needs to get below that $400 mark with some of these products. They're rumored to be out in August, so that's not too far if it's true. But again, it's all kind of rumor mongering.
So if you're looking for a pretty notebook and you're looking for Windows, we've obviously showed off some of these spectacular new models in the Dell XPS series. If you want to get something even more shockingly attractive, you might want to take a look at HP's NV14 Spectre Review. Performance-wise, says Matt Smith, not a lot to talk about. We're not looking at an Ivy Bridge upgrade on there. There's the Intel Core i5 2467M, HD 3000 graphics, 4GB DDR3, well, for RAM, 128GB Samsung SSD. What you want to look at is the big, shiny glass lid, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, HP actually has a stylish design that looks particularly stylish. They've done it before. But if you take a look at it, basically it's a big, thick, beautiful glass lid, and it opens up to a pretty good looking screen, actually, and Beats Audio. If you are a fan of Beats Audio, you might want to give it a little extra bonus for that. It's interesting to see HP. It's kind of funny because HP is doing a lot to differentiate. Traditionally, HP is like, we do shiny black. And this is a shiny black notebook. but the majority of the notebooks in HP's more affordable lineup, this starts at around $1,400, are they're really big on texture and really big on colors. As in a rainbow of colors and textures that are built into the designs. So this is something they're looking for. More high-end people are, I don't know, more sophisticated or more high-end. The line starts at $1,400, which is not inexpensive these days for a notebook. No. But it looks to be of delightful quality and particularly striking visually if you're into the big, shiny, black glass back. My only question, of course, being is how long will it take me to cover it with my grubby little fingerprints? But many of you are not as greasy as I am, so it's probably not an issue.
This is the laptop I came away from CES really thinking I liked the most. Mm-hmm. I think maybe not having a laptop in front of me for that many months, kind of, I was like, maybe I'm not as super interested right now anyway. But I still think it looks really nice.
It's beautiful. It is a very striking design. It's one of those designs. Yep. It's kind of like the carbon fiber on the Dell. You're either going to go, oh, that's really cool, or you're going to be like, that's so 80s. That's such an induction cooktop. Meanwhile, Penny Arcade Report, which is the sort of newsy branch of Penny Arcade, one of my favorite art cartoons, has done kind of an editorial. The reality of the Ouya, I believe it's called the Ouya, Ouya console, sure, doesn't match the hype. Why you should be skeptical. In case you don't live life on Kickstarter.com, you may have not actually heard about the Ouya project. Ouya, a new kind of video game console, 33,000 backers to the tune of $4,246,675 against a goal of $950,000. And they still have 27 days to go. So this will definitely be funded. But the idea is that it's a $99 console that is totally open. So Scythem from Reddit comments, I've wasted $100 on stupid things. This actually looks cool. Is the $99 Ouya, says PC World, the video game console for the 99%. And Gadget says gamers are craving something different. And if the Ouya is a success, it could usher us into a new golden age of gaming. 420 or at 420 says a new console for $99 that is designed around a free-to-play open source model. I support everything about at play Ouya if you want to follow it on Twitter. PA reports like, yeah. It's great that they raised all that money, but, quote, there is almost no information about the state of production hardware, says Penny Arcade. And it is, in fact, nearly everything about the system seems to be in flux. The Kickstarter page contradicts itself on some points, and many of the images and statements seem to be intentionally misleading. Quote, while there are many aspects of the Ouya game console that are attractive, there are many more reasons to be skeptical about what's being offered. Case in point, it actually doesn't exist. There's maybe a prototype out there. They don't have a final design for the controller. One thing I thought was interesting, Ouya cannot confirm a single game for the platform. Quote, not at this time, I was told. Ben Kuchera over at penny-arcade.com/report. I was asked if they can confirm a single game for the platform. Not at this time. We are obviously talking to developers behind the scenes, says Ouya, but feel that it's too early to announce. At which point, he's like, but wait, isn't Minecraft a game that will run on the Ouya? Quote, Mojang has committed that Minecraft and their other games will be on Ouya, the Kickstarter page stated. The next sentence, however, makes it very clear that this is not the case. Quote, but only if we prove that we can make a great product. That's our job, and enough people want their games. That's your job. Show them with your numbers that you want Minecraft on Ouya. You know, so what we have here is a group of people in LA very excited about making a new kind of console that doesn't have you strapped to the back. I'm going to just stop, keep everything G-rated. I was about to go into a really hideous metaphor that would have, you know, what has been heard cannot be unheard. But the short answer is like, this is a really interesting idea, right? $100 Ouya. That's really cool. Right, $100 for a console. That's really cool. A, what Penny Arcade Report saying is if they can build it. B, if there are games on it. And C, if they deliver it sometime while it's still relevant. And given the incredible pain and suffering it takes for somebody like, Xbox or, you know, Microsoft or Sony or someone, you know, with a radically different model that kind of started with the games and worked in technology and worked into a console idea from there, like OnLive, I think this is going to be really interesting to watch, and I think it's going to be really challenging for them to actually deliver this because they're apparently claiming they're going to have a console by March of next year that they haven't, you know. You think they can do it, Ryan? I mean, obviously, I'm a little fascinated by this, but
the hardware is simple enough, right? Like, they said it was going to be like a Tegra 3 based Android device. Fine, whatever. Right. You can do that. This is more of an ecosystem problem than anything else. So I don't know. I would feel better about it if they had some kind of like major name associated with it, you know, like some major player in the game space, some vendor, some person, some company, some developer that had some pull, was kind of interested in it. Maybe now, and it's true, maybe now they will get that now that they have $4 million invested from 30 something thousand different people. Right. So, you know, we'll see. But I had a great idea for a game console, though, Patrick. It's called Booyah. And it's going to be based on Tegra 4. It's going to have 19 gigabytes of memory. And it may come out one day.
Ixnay on the e-tail days. We'll call it Booyah. Yeah. And promise everything, deliver very few specific details so you can't be held in breach of something later.
It will be based on a future part. How about that?
Ryan Schrout's Booyah concept, bringing the great. And it's kind of funny because the next thing they did is after they looked around like blinking, and because they'd made like $2 million the first day it was up on Kickstarter, is they put together, they asked for suggestions and got like 45,000 suggestions for games, and then summarized into a list of like the top 20 games people wanted to see on it. So they're obviously looking to deliver some kind of power on this thing. I mean, it's interesting because you look at somebody like, Google delivering the Nexus Q. I bring that up because some people are saying the Nexus Q, okay, so all it's got is Google Play and all it's got is Google Movies, and there's no Netflix and there's no Amazon Video on Demand, and there's no, and the list goes on and on and on. And it's kind of weird because it's got like an audiophile amplifier and a little silver box, and you can't really do anything with it unless you already have an Android device to send stuff to it. Oh yeah, one of the rare Android devices with 4.1 for an operating system, or you hack it. What a lot of things people are saying is the Nexus Q is a really easy way to turn Android games into console games because the Q will be connected to an HDTV, so you will have the ability to run games on it. You know, kind of a backdoor into the living room for Google after the desperate Google Television experience. So, you know what? I hope Booyah does fantastic. I hope they come up with a gigantically cool list of games. I hope I'm sitting in a year from now kicking myself going, I should have pre-ordered that. By the way, speaking of pre-ordering, they finally shipped. In 1 week, I will have a Raspberry Pi.
Nice.
after waiting for several years, it feels like, even though it was only several
years. That almost feels like this, and it doesn't really, because it kind of feels like the same kind of project, though, right, that finally came to fruition.
There was a real picture of a real product and a real board that had an actual real production capability. It just scaled a little slower than we all would have liked to. So
yeah, you're right.
Oh, my goodness. Meanwhile, by the way, Nexus 7, everybody loves the Nexus 7, even Walt Mossberg. He's got some caveats, but he says it's an amazing piece of hardware for $200. I agree. I am tempted to buy a Nexus 7, and the last thing I need is a fourth tablet around the house. But apparently a whole lot of people needed tablets because AppleInsider.com is suggesting that 20 million iPad sales were projected for Apple's June quarter. Basically, they expect Apple to do a report that says they sold 20 million iPads in the June quarter, up from 13.5 million units originally expected. quote, in our view, it's only a matter of time before iPad shipments exceed iPhone shipments. The iPad is invading the business market at a much faster pace than the iPhone. The iPad will launch on China on July 20th. So it's going to be interesting to see, right? Google stepping in with the Nexus 7 to try to really consolidate Android tablet sales. Amazon number, not really talking a whole about it, but Amazon market presumed to be somewhat smaller, the Amazon being a subset of all Android. But I think it's going to be really interesting to watch where Android tablets and the iPad are coming into Q4 and the holiday shopping season. So,
I agree.
Is Ken been testing the Cat Leap?
So yes, we have been. Ken has been doing some of this. Actually, we're gonna switch over here. We've got it sitting right here. You can see from this shot right here, it's cut off maybe just a little bit there because we're zoomed in. But this is our 27-inch Cat Leap display. No, this is not. What is this? This is a Shimian Shimian vendor. It is a 27-inch. I think he got it for $319 shipped. From Korea, got here in 3 days. Literally from Korea to Florence, Kentucky in 3 days. And you can see here, I can't really face it. So we've been doing some testing with it. Right now it's hooked up to his MacBook Air. But we have run it through some tests on Windows. We did some latency testing, that kind of thing. We looked for dead pixels. Our model has no dead pixels.
Nice.
And it does some things that I think most people said it wouldn't do, like accept the resolution lower than 2560 by 1440. We were able to push 19 by 10, 1080p at it, right? And other resolutions, we sent 1024 by 768 at it because we had to when we connected a CRT monitor to the system and did the mirroring on it, right? So that was a lot of fun. But you can see here, this isn't its full 2560 resolution. So while I can't see my cursor or anything, you can get an idea of how many pixels you're actually looking at there, because you can see the PC per site in the window, and you still have tons of space for anything else. And it's been pretty impressive. The only kind of downside we have so far is that it's a glossy screen. So if you have a big issue with glossy screens, it could be a problem. Really, right. This is the only monitor we have in this place that has a glossy screen, right? The Apple Thunderbolt display has a glossy screen. It's actually, apparently from what we've read, this is the same panel that Apple uses on their 27-inch Thunderbolt display. But this is like the next step down, like the A-minus panels, I guess, is what they're calling it in terms of like binning of the displays. So, but if you're talking about a third of the price, right?
Right.
That's pretty impressive.
All those beautiful pixels.
Yeah, and we'll have that story written up maybe tonight, maybe tomorrow. But we've been really impressed with it so far. You know, there's some funny things about it, like there's speaker cutouts on the back, even though there's no speakers in it. There's a set of six buttons on the back, like for on-screen displays, but there's only two buttons that actually function, and it's just brightness levels up or down. There is no on-screen display.
Really? So there's no color calibration capabilities in there?
No. You have to do all that through Windows or through an external device.
Again, Kazi Cat Leap has it.
We don't know. I think the reason we got this one, what did you pick this one over the Cat Leap again? The stand basically seemed a little bit stronger from the reports that we'd seen. It's a little bit more sturdy and that kind of stuff. It does have VESA mounts on the back. What's that?
Ken and his rational decision making.
Yeah, I know. No, it's crazy. But
you gotta buy it by the name, man, not the usable features.
that was my take too. I mean, so far we've been pretty impressed. It's, you know, the hangups are really more on the lines of, do you trust the seller because they're all through eBay and they're all these third parties? I think in our story, we're going to link to the person that we bought ours from because we got a tracking number right away. And like I said, it showed up in 3 days and, you know, everything seemed up to speed. And actually, I think they're a little bit cheaper now, $305 shipped for this 2560 by 1440 display, which is pretty cool. Like, I don't have any need for any more high res displays, to be perfectly honest with you. We've got 30 inches. Ken says he's buying another one. So that's a good endorsement, I guess, right? Because he works in front of high-end displays all day.
And the new GPU, he needs to power them for gaming, all for less than the cost of a single Apple 30-inch display.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you can, like, if you buy three of these, it would be $915 shipped, right? So you can get three of these displays for less than the Apple Thunderbolt display or the Dell 30-inch panels and that kind of stuff. So it's pretty impressive. So look for that review. We'll have it up maybe tonight, definitely tomorrow. For you guys to check that out. We did. The high-speed latency testing is interesting.
Interesting.
Not as exact a science as I thought it was going to be because of the way the scan lines work and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, so we'll have that up for you soon.
So if you've been looking for a 27-inch LCD flat panel at the 2560 by 1440 or 1600 resolution and paled with fright at the fact that even the low-end monitors were $700, ladies and gentlemen, PC Per, Mr. Ryan Shroud, and Ken in the lab are going to have answers for you tomorrow. We love your questions, which is why we want you to email us. Twitch, twich@twit.tv is the email address. Or you can get your Twitter on at Ryan Shroud or at Patrick Norton. And we should take a moment to move over to questions. Now,
sure.
I think we actually answered the first one on the list last week.
Oh, did we? Okay. I mean, maybe cut off at the wrong spot. So
that's okay. But we do have a great question on drive reliability and burn-in from San. He says, hey, guy, I'm sorry. I have to take a moment. We've been playing with the font that our show notes are in, and somehow it went from like Arial to Times Roman to Arial to Comic Sans, and you know, ladies and gentlemen,
just bothering each other,
Comic Sans for a moment. Friends, don't let friends use Comic Sans because it just hurts.
Yeah.
So Sam says, hey, guys, I love the show. Thank you, Sam. Love to tinker with computers, and it's great to have a solid podcast about the hardware. That's what we're trying to deliver for you. Thanks for listening. He says, I wanted to ask about two things. If you'd be so kind as to answer, you'd be able to help me out with my build tremendously. Number one, I'm building a new gaming PC for myself, and I'm going with an SSD for my operating system installation, and I'm trying to find a good hard drive for high-capacity storage. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to find solid reviews for any drives over 1 terabyte. All seem to suffer from reliability issues. Is it best to stick with lower-capacity drives that are more reliable, or to buy whatever high-capacity drive has the best warranty? I know that the Eco drives are the cheapest out there, but I understand they have the worst reliability due to what I'm guessing has to do with a lot of head parking. Two, what are the first 5 things you guys like to do when completing a new build? I've heard that it can be advantageous to run stress tests on the CPU with Prime 95 for hours, the GPU with something like 3D Mark for hours, and Memtest as well. Is it dangerous to stress test your new CPU or GPU when they're brand new? Is there any way to run a hard drive through its paces? P.S., in your opinions, is synchronous NAND flash worth the extra few bucks? I've done my research, but I wanted to know your opinions. Thanks so much, Patrick and Ryan. Sam from Pittsburgh. You know, I think most of the reliability issues for larger hard drives are because people stuff them into RAID enclosures and do terrible things to them. I'm running 1 terabyte, 2 terabyte, and 3 terabyte drives, and I've got at least 4 3 terabyte Western Digital Greens stuffed into a PC with a Core i5, and they're all running fine. So I don't have any particular issues with the larger capacity hard drives.
I mean, there's the potential there. The only reason a higher capacity drive would have more potential failure. So like there's 2 reasons. Either you have more platters inside the drive, so you're generating more heat and there's a little potential there, or using higher density platters, which means there's less room for error in terms of read and that kind of stuff. So I mean, there's something to be said for that, but I don't think it is enough to worry about, right? You might worry about your vendor or your series of drive less than the capacity, unless there's some specific problem with some specific series of drives, like 2 terabytes from some vendor and some line and some, you know, sequence of numbers, something like that, that you might want to avoid. But other than that, no, I don't think getting 1 terabyte is somehow more stable than getting 2 terabytes.
Yeah, I mean, the Western Digital Caviar Green seemed to hold up really well. I think StorageReview.com, they have their sort of StorageReview.com/best drives or best_drives. That's kind of their equivalent to the PC Per leaderboard. They're big fans of the Hitachi DeskStar 7K3000. Mm-hmm. Those run up to 3 terabytes. You know, I like the greens. I don't want the greens for my primary drive on a computer, but they're fine for storage. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you, Ryan, do you think synchronous NAND flash is worth the extra few bucks?
No.
Yeah. You know, most of the stuff it just seems like most of the stuff people are looking at with like memory speeds and stuff like that, if you can even benchmark the difference in performance, you're certainly not going to feel it. The part of this question I love the most is the first 5 things you guys like to do in completing a new build.
Right.
Burn-in is the phrase you're looking for, and everybody should burn in a new PC, if only for one reason, is because the majority of component failures on a PC will take place almost immediately, like in the first 48 or 72 hours. Generally, if the resistors on the motherboard, if all the bits and pieces inside the chip survive the first couple days, they're pretty much going to run for years and years and years, barring...
Oh, we have a frozen Patrick. But what he's saying was correct, and that the majority of these errors do happen early on in a PC's life. So doing burn-in accomplishes a couple of goals. It helps you find those if they're going to be an issue. And it also can do some lets you do some temperature testing, right? Because you would rather, if your system's going to crash and have issues, you would much rather it do it during this initial burn-in phase than when you're playing Battlefield 3 for the 3rd hour that night. Right. So that kind of makes sense. That's the burn in. I'm kind of guilty of not doing that enough because I just assume stuff is going to work. But we build a lot of hardware here. And I know it can be difficult to, once you've put together all this good stuff, to leave it for 2 full days while it cycles in Prime 95 or something and hits 80, 90 degrees Celsius temperatures. But it'll help you kind of find those things out early. Right.
Yeah, I mean, it'll let you know if it's going to run at reasonable temperatures. You know, you may run it for the first 2 days, everything runs fine, and think to yourself, I'm going to go spend $50 on a new cooler for the CPU because this one's so freaking loud.
I would say my second thing would be, obviously, like the initial setup of all those applications is a pain. What's that? Nynite? Is that still a thing? What is it?
Nynite. N-I-N-I-T-E.
There you go. .com.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Nope. It allows you to, oh my goodness, what's the easy way to describe it? Basically, Nynite makes it super fast. If you go to Nynite.com, you basically can pre-configure the web browsers you want installed. You know, it basically, if you look at the Nynite.com webpage, it'll you know, it gives you an idea of what you're looking at. You know, you can pick all the web browsers you want, messaging tools like Skype, Dixby, Trillion, AIM, Google Talk, iTunes, VLC, FUBAR 2000, K-Lite, Codex, GOM, MediaMonkey, Hulu, AIMP, Audacity, Spotify, you know, Flash, Silverlight, Shockwave, all kinds of applications in all kinds of different areas. And the idea is that basically you pick your apps. You click Get Installer, and Nynite takes care of dumping everything onto your machine. So it's Robert Herron, actually, on Techzilla, is a huge fan of Nynite. I wish that Nynite existed to speed up the installation of drivers on a new PC. That's, like, the most frustrating thing for me. You know, it's like, yeah, you get the machine running, you load all your drivers, you know, you burn them in Prive 95 and you know, you burn in your GPU, you get everything configured, you get all your motherboard settings configured. And then I would say, like, you know, you're running Nynite, everything's good to go. When it feels like everything's set exactly the way you want it, that's a really good time to image your system. You know, use imaging software to create a complete backup of that clean, fresh installation onto another drive so that if you decide to wipe it, you know, I'm a big fan of putting all of my data and information and storing that all on a separate hard drive and then putting all my, you know, my primary information or my operating system, my primary applications on their own partition so that if I just get frustrated, I can wipe out the operating system and reinstall it and not have to deal with losing any of my data. And, of course, having an image makes that a much, much faster process.
Yes, I agree that, you know, like the idea of a system restore point kind of like is a great idea. It's never been implemented correctly. I would love to be able to, I guess Apple does that with snapshots and Time Machine and that kind of stuff where you can just kind of revert back to these certain things. But Nynite is a close second. Do you have anything else that you always do right when you build a new PC?
Start thinking about buying yet another uninterruptible power supply for my house.
Yes. Yeah. Just yeah. I don't know if there's anything else specific. You know, it's like I do my things, which would be, you know, do a little bit of a burn-in testing, kind of performance testing. I'll do a little benchmarking and make sure that, you know, the graphics card is running as fast as it's supposed to be. The CPU is running as fast as it's supposed to be. You can download the free versions of like Cysoft Sandra for that. Look at your CPU scores, go online, you know, compare your CPU scores to others. Make sure you're getting everything set correctly. Make sure your memory, all your memory showed up and that kind of thing. Kind of make sure all the performance metrics are there. And then it goes to like installing Steam and starting all those downloads and then going to bed. It's kind of
motherboard stuff. How that starts. Drives me insane. I've never seen anybody do like the universal motherboard configuration guide. Because it's always frustrating when, like, motherboard manufacturer A and motherboard manufacturer B have completely different names for the exact same features. By the way, I would not try to run a hard drive through its paces. The last thing I want to do is take any of the hours away from the meantime between failure for no particular reason. There's no real reason to try to break in or burn in a hard drive. And it is not dangerous to stress test your CPU or GPU when they're brand new or if they're old. Even if you've done something particularly ridiculous, like forget to mount a cooler on your CPU, your system's going to start. It's going to be like, I'm too hot, and it's going to very gracefully shut down. Or, you know, gracefully for the CPU, maybe not for your operating system installation. But you have to pretty much overvolt the thing with a set of jumpers, cables, you know, and some high voltage electricity to hurt a CPU these days if it's attached to the motherboard. If it's properly installed on the motherboard, you know.
They're much safer than they used to be.
Yeah, you used to be able to melt down a CPU if you got a little too crazy with it. And nowadays, you know, Intel and AMD are like, no, the CPU is going to get too hot, and then it's going to start throttling down, then it's going to shut itself down. We're not going to let you kill it. which is kind of cool. Should we answer Calder's email question about home servers?
Yeah, this is interesting one. He says, I'm planning on building a new home server soon. Currently, he has a Windows home server version 1, and it runs Atom 330 with Ion graphics. He's planning on either going with an Ivy Bridge or Sandy Bridge Core i3 or a Llano or Trinity APU. I intend to run either Windows Home Server 2011 or Windows 8 with storage spaces for my operating system. Backups are important, but I also use CrashPlan. Mainly, I wish this to be a media server that can also back up my files. In the one system crash I've had, I just reinstalled rather than pull my last image over and then just brought all my files back over. I figured a clean system was better at that point. Mainly, I want to know whether the better GPUs in Llano or Trinity will have any effect in running PS3 Media Server, iTunes, AirVideo, Plex, and similar media server applications. We stream to a Roku with Plex, Apple TV with iTunes, iPads and iPhones with AirVideo, and a PS3 with the PS3 Media Server. We only run PS3 Media Server on the WHS V1 box now, with everything else running on a Core i7 870 and GTX 460 system that gets used for basic tasks. Does the GPU matter for streaming media to my devices? Yes, highlighted as we see right there. I would say probably not, because right. The majority of the time the streaming is actually, it's just sending out raw data. And it's up to the receiving device to decode that. Now, there are exceptions to that where, like, AirPlay, I think it does decoding and it sends up the actual video stream, for example. But the GPU performance is probably not a big factor in that type of machine. Now, when you get into power consumption, that's a different story, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm just gonna say I'm trying to think of like what would do that. Plex, no. I'm trying to think of any of the UPnP media servers that do transcoding on the fly, and I'm trying to think of any of them would actually take advantage of a GPU, and I don't think any of them do. I'd love to get an email from anybody in the audience who knows different Twitch at twit.tv, but
yeah.
I'm up with the Wikipedia's like insane list of UPnP AV media servers, and I'm like not seeing anything that like just diverse.
Now, if you use your media server to do transcoding,
right?
Then maybe the transcoding application will take advantage of the GPU, right?
But I don't even think they do.
Handbrake will take advantage of the APUs starting, I think, in its next version release. So that might be something interesting to think about. To get a Llano or a Trinity desktop is not out yet, so you're still buying Llano stuff, and in honesty, the Llano processor would make great for a great system for that use. And if you happen to be able to take advantage of the extra GPU power, then great. And if not, well, I guess.
There you have it. I think we got time for one last question before we go this week.
Sure.
Josh's question about GPUs under $200 again, which, hey, it's my favorite sort of GPU buying area, the under $2. Josh says, hi, guys. I love the podcast. Listen to every new episode when it arrives. Thank you, Josh. If you get a chance, do us a favor. Tell your friends. twit.tv/Twitch. Says, my question is regarding upgrading my ancient Radeon HD 4830 that currently lives my gaming machine. I used to have a 4870, but was forced to downgrade after my car died, and 4830 is what I had laying around. What would you recommend for under $200 for playing today's games and maxed out settings? My current rig has a Core i7. I could have swore we answered this one. 920 overclocked to 3.9 gigahertz with 6 gigs of the DDR3. Thanks for the advice and keep up the good work. I bet it's going to be an AMD or an ATI.
Yeah, it does sound very familiar now that I think it's a different email.
Okay.
But I think it has a very similar question. The main problem I have with the question is it doesn't mention what resolution he's running at, and that's very important when he talks about he wanted to play the games with maxed out settings.
Let's assume 1080p. It's okay. A pretty safe assumption at this point. It's going to be 1080p or lower.
I don't think for $200 you can get a card that will actually let you, quote, max out all the settings on all of the games, on a lot of the games, but not all of the games. Like, you're not going to be able to do it on Battlefield 3. You're not going to be able to do it on Metro 2033. You're not going to be able to do it on, Crysis 2. You can have really good settings, but you're not going to be able to maximize them for $200. And yes, and we kind of answered this earlier in the show, right? NVIDIA doesn't have a good $200 card option right now. If you want like a latest generation product, you're really looking at like the Radeon 7850, I think. Let me see here what it says the lowest price of those are. I think it's just over $200. Yeah. Yes, this is very similar to what we had before because it's the same debate. For about $210 to $220, you can get a 7850. And then the next step down is the 7770. It's like $140, and it's way different performance class. So I would say for $210, $220, get a 7850 today if that's what you want to do. But just don't – I don't want this person to go in there you know, really expecting to be able to max out all of these settings because I don't – they're not going to be able to. They're going to get good settings but not the best settings.
I think it's safe to say the performance difference between a 7850 pardon me, and your 4830 is going to be incredible, and your eyes are going to bleed with joy.
Yes.
But, yeah, if, you know, you're going to be getting crazy with Battlefield 3 on a 27-inch Cat Leap or the beautiful 27-inch monitor that was to Ryan's right, you may want to find another $100 to drop or $200 to drop on that GPU. But the 7850 is going to be a massive, massive upgrade in GPU performance that you're running right now. So, which is a good thing.
Yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Patrick Norton. You can find me at TechZilla. Well, actually, you can find me at TechZilla.com. It's the twice weekly show I do with Veronica Belmont and Robert Heron, or at HD Nation. Rubensview.com/HD Nation is where you can find our weekly show where we review a whole lot of HD TVs, home theater gear, and HD content. Mr. Ryan Shrout is usually found at PCPer.com. What's coming up this week on PCPer, Ryan?
So we've already kind of teased our Korean monitor review pretty heavily. We'll also have a look at this weird-looking thing with all these cables hanging off it. This is the Thunderbolt EX. This is the add-on card for the ASUS Z77 motherboards that will enable a Thunderbolt connection on motherboards that don't have it, but only certain motherboards. So we've already talked about Thunderbolt performance, and this will help you actually get that on other systems. And then we'll also be taking a look at... I spent some time with the... beautiful yet incredibly expensive MacBook Pro with the high res display, the 2880 by 1800. I spent pretty much all my time in a boot camp environment, just kind of running some performance tests, getting some screenshots. I did get to play Skyrim at 2880 by 1800, and I gotta tell you, it looked awesome. It wasn't a very high frame rate because I turned everything up really high. I just wanted to get a couple of screenshots of what 2880 by 1800 looked like, and it was pretty impressive. But yeah, I would love to have one of those machines, but I don't think I can make myself pay $2,300 for one. So,
ladies and gentlemen, the hardware lust of even Ryan Shroud. Several months worth of mortgage payments, new gaming PC. Even Ryan sometimes has to say no. Ladies and gentlemen, that's about it for this edition of Twitch. TWICH at twit.tv is the email address. You've got a question for us. I am Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Trout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.